I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're taking a look at how some Jewish communities are rethinking ways to both welcome and include families in which one partner is of another faith.
We'll also discuss attempts to revive some Jewish rituals by marketing them to urban, millennial, all about the Instagram crowds. I'll have a related interview with Kaya Oakes, a terrific writer and professor in the Bay Area, whose most recent book took a close look at the fastest growing religious demographic in America, those who say they have no religious affiliation.
We're recording this episode on the last night of Hanukkah, so we felt it was especially appropriate that two stories about Jewish communities and Jewish religious life caught our eyes this week. I've known about this first one for a while. It was written by one of my closest friends, journalist Holly Rossi. And she and I have talked for years about how various American Jewish institutions have responded to what is truly a remarkable development that she reports in this piece. 7 in 10 non-Orthodox Jews, so Jews who are either Reform or Conservative or really just culturally Jewish, who have married since 2000 have non-Jewish spouses. That's 7 in 10.
7 in 10?
Yeah. This is definitely a development that has freaked out a lot of Jewish leaders, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
But given that this number has kept growing over the last few decades and is now, and this was, I guess, 2013 found the 7 in 10 number, I would imagine that it's going to keep trending in that direction. A lot of groups have decided, you know, we need to stop figuring out how to turn this trend around and figure out how to deal with it. And I have been wanting us to talk about this for a little bit because I am one of those non-Jewish spouses, and my husband is one of those 7 in 10 who are, you know, curdling the stomachs of some of the leaders of the Jewish community. I think it's useful just because we have spent years and years and years figuring out how to set up our own little interfaith family so that it works for us. And I find sometimes by writing about it and talking about it that it can be a useful model for other people. But in the course of that, we've also had a chance to interact with a number of different rabbis, a number of synagogues, JCCs, Jewish schools, and we have run into a variety of responses to me being not only not Jewish, but also not wanting to raise our children simply as Jewish children and in the Jewish tradition. And what we have found is most troubling to a lot of folks is not just that I am not Jewish, but that I am a practicing Christian. In fact, when we moved out here to Evanston, we had our son signed up at what seemed like just the loveliest little preschool. And Noam had done all of the pre-interviewing and the talking with the woman who ran the school. And we had our little buddy all signed up. And I just thought I'd stop by and take a look at it because mama likes to know where her son is going to be. And once it came up that I was not only not Jewish, but that I am a Christian who goes to church and takes the kids to Sunday school with me, even though we also are very passionate about making sure that we have Jewish culture in our home and observe Jewish holidays, and my husband speaks Hebrew to the kids, we got a phone call that it was not actually going to be possible for our son to attend preschool at this place. Not unless we promised to have him convert. And I have to say, Nish, it was a really good preschool. I didn't consider having him convert, but I definitely was like, why don't we just tell them that we're going to, you know, how are they going to know?
Right.
Not realizing that this is not like the Christian backgrounds that I have known where, you know, it's up to the kid to decide that he is going to become a Christian. No, this was a process we would have needed to start then and promise that we would finish by the end of the year. And it really wasn't up to our son at all. It would be something that we were deciding for him, which is just not something I'm familiar with, but was just one little example of how it can be tricky to navigate the world of having spouses from two different religious backgrounds. And in this case, one of the observations I've had is that it is just as different having one of us from a practicing religious background and the other from a very non-observant and non-believing background as it is being Christian and Jewish.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, just for the clarification for our listeners. Your husband is Jewish. He is from Israel.
Well, his mother is Israeli.
Oh, yeah. His mother is Israeli. But he is not a practicing religious Jew.
Definitely not.
He is. Yeah. It's more cultural. This is his background. This is his heritage. He is, you know, a man of that land. He is, you know, that's just kind of his family history, which is different than being a, you know, practicing religious Jewish person. And I don't know if some people realize that there's those that kind of like differential, or that like difference between being a cultural Jew and being a practicing religious Jew. And they oftentimes overlap, but a lot of times they don't, which I think is really interesting in your case, because your husband, like you said, is not actually a practicing religious person.
Yeah. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't necessarily think through, no matter what their religious background is, unless they're forced to, like we were, because, you know, I went to divinity school. I've studied all sorts of religions of the world and, you know, had friends and knew of folks who were, you know, culturally of a religious background. But I really didn't know what we were getting into, and he didn't either, until we had to, before we got engaged, really hash it out about what it would mean to have children and have us from two very different backgrounds. And it was kind of a process for him of figuring out what his Judaism actually meant to him. Because when we started, I think it's fair to say on his behalf that it was more a matter of defining Judaism against what it was not. It was not being Christian. So that was a big concern, was that if our kids were Christian, then they could not be Jewish. And where I stood, I thought, well, you don't even believe there is a Messiah, so why do you care who I think the Messiah is?
Right.
To me, it was obvious. Well, they will be religiously Christian and culturally Jewish. But that was not how he felt, and that was not how all of my Jewish friends who were like, oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, that's not going to fly.
That is not going to be the solution there. And yet, that is kind of where we are at this moment. You know, I will caution that this is just a snapshot of where we are now. Our kids are 7 and 4, and they will no doubt continue to change since they are spirited and stubborn individuals. But for at least right at this moment, we have some measure of what I would call success in terms of both of us being pretty happy with what we are able to teach the children about our two backgrounds and how the kids think about it. You know, our daughter had a little extra help here in that she started going part-time to a Jewish preschool when she was 2. Then she went to the JCC for a year for preschool. And then she had this fantastic after-school program that was in Washington, D.C., that was 3 afternoons a week of basically Hebrew immersion and teaching about Jewish culture and Jewish religious traditions and about Israel, which was perfect. Her Safta, her grandmother, is from Israel. And my husband's family is all in Israel, at least his cousins and aunts and uncles. And so that is really kind of the cultural attachment that we wanted her to have. And yet she's also been going to the Baptist church with me since she was a baby. And I tried to tell him this when we first started talking about all of this years and years ago, probably 10 years ago now. I don't think he bought it at the time, but it has since proved to be exactly as I promised, which is it's a great thing that I am Baptist because we don't believe in infant baptism. So it's not like I was going to immediately walk the kids over to the church and have them baptized and like, boom, they're Christian. Said it's going to be a matter for them to decide, as it is for every couple who says we're going to raise our kids knowing about two different traditions and they choose. Now, most families where they say that, the kids end up being kind of nothing. So the one thing I knew I wanted is to have our kids have a chance, at least, of having a faith, a sense of faith that was important to them. And, you know, again, kids are kids. You can raise them with whatever you want, and they may, you know, grow up and decide to do their own thing. But I wanted them to at least have the language, to have the models for it. And while we could have decided to raise them to be religiously Jewish, I thought that was going to be tough because I am the religious parent and I am not Jewish, and the Jewish parent is not religious. So what we decided is that I would take the kids to church with me, and I don't think we had any idea it was going to be a weekly thing. But now that it's been going on for 7 years, man, I could not imagine not having my kids with me in church every week. And our daughter says that she's Christian and she's Jewish. She's both, because her mama is Christian and her Abba is Jewish. So as their child, why wouldn't she be both? Our little guy, he is all about the baby Jesus. He loves Jesus so much and loves his Bible stories. He's tiny and he has not been to Jewish preschool. We've got to get him in. But, you know, he loves the holidays, and he understands Hebrew, even if he does not speak it. And when he's out visiting my in-laws, he is in full Hebrew immersion at all times. So again, like I said, we are at just a snapshot moment, but for us, it has been a cautiously optimistic experiment, and but one that we have had to do mostly on our own, with support here and there from institutions that are willing to work with us. And so we haven't fully gotten involved with our local synagogue down the block, but you can be sure that we went and talked to the rabbi there last year just to make sure that she knew who I was and she was cool with that. And not only are they open to interfaith families, but you will love this, they are a sister congregation with the Baptist church that we are going to join.
Wow, look at that. Very exciting.
I feel like that is divinely ordained.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love these little stories of kind of these like interfaith dynamics. We live in Salt Lake City. I mean, our interfaith dialogue is obviously not as intense because my husband and I share the same faith, and our kids are being raised Christian. But we are, evangelical-ish, I think I've said that, Christians. But we live in Salt Lake City, Utah. If you know anything about Utah, it's really Mormon. And so we are in the presence of an entirely different, like, faith tradition. And the Mormon faith really does have its own culture. It is very Jewish in that way. There is, like, being a religious Mormon, a practicing Mormon, and being a cultural Mormon that exists here. And then both of my kids have gone to a Jewish preschool. So they've gotten, like, kind of all the different, like, realms of it. Like, my daughter recently, bless it, was like, so on Christmas, does Santa come down the chimney of the temple downtown and light the menorah? And I was like, oh dear. We're going to have a chat because this is, I think we're a little confused. And so it's really darling. Like, she has, you know, friends who are Jewish, and she has friends that are Christian, and she has friends that are Mormon. And I mean, just like all across the board. And so it is, it has been really fun to see my kids interact with different faith traditions. So I can't even imagine how much more intense, but also in some ways how sweet it is to have that actually be your child's family tradition, is to be interfaith, and really how beautiful that can be. I think as Christians, we are trained to kind of have like our hackles go up about it a little bit, but I find it to be really beautiful. So I don't know. I love hearing about you and your family. It's just so sweet. And your kids are so cute.
Well, it is. It's definitely uneven in a way that I acknowledge puts the burden on me to be sensitive, because as I think you might agree, we as Christians claim a lot of Jewish history as our own. And yet it does not go the other way. When we go to Israel, and we took the kids for the first time last winter, every part of that history I know, and I know really, really well. I love going to Jerusalem as much as I love driving around the Galilee and being like, that is where Jesus was sailing, and start singing, I Will Make You Fishers of Men. And says, what are you doing? And yet, you know, that's obviously not a part of his tradition. And so, it, you know, in some ways, I have discovered from doing a lot of reading about interfaith couples and families, we have avoided some sticking points because I am religious. Because for folks who aren't, symbols become more important. And so, you know, having a tree up can be a big problem for a lot of families. We actually do have a little tabletop tree this year, but it's just because, again, our son is in like full baby Jesus mode, and 4 years old is like the prime loving Christmas age.
Oh, it's magic.
But in general, like, a Christmas tree is, for me, it's not Christmas. I mean, it's not the religious observance of the Savior's birth, nor is having stockings up or red and green everywhere. And for Easter, I don't care about Easter baskets and the Easter bunny, you know.
But can we agree that Easter candy is the best candy?
We cannot agree that Easter bunny is the best candy. We'll discuss that in the spring.
Oh my gosh. Okay, let's move on.
But it's just to say that those are not the things that I want to pass down to my kids. If they grew up and when they had their own families, they put up Easter baskets and Christmas trees, but they didn't have a sense of what those faiths, those holidays meant, then I would have failed.
Right. That's exactly right.
And, you know, that's a way that we can maintain some level of comfort for everybody in the family. So nobody feels like they're being excluded here. And yet, you know, we put up a sukkah for Sukkot because that's the more culturally oriented holiday that my husband feels more closely to. And I can be part of that because it's not challenging any part of my faith. So that's just one of the variety of interesting things we've come across. I will say it makes it a little more complicated for me, for my own personal faith, because like I've always loved the season of Advent, but this year we get a little bit into Advent and then we got to stop and like do the Maccabees narrative for a little bit. And then now
push,
we're
pause,
stopping
Hanukkah
tonight.
Time.
Yes. And now we pick up the Christmas narrative again. And don't even get me started on Passover and Easter, because it kills me every year. But, you know, that's all right. I can take on that extra part. As the mother, I also take on the extra, like, reminding everybody when the Jewish holidays are going to be every year. This year, I did not have to buy the candles for Hanukkah, but that would be the first year, I believe. I have not been the one to buy those. I took our son this afternoon to go shopping for some items that we are going to be donating. His school is collecting things for folks who are on the streets to make sure that, you know, there are life necessities that they have. And I talked to him about how this is our mitzvah that we are doing for the season of Hanukkah. And, you know, I think it's really important that it not just be lighting the candles and eating gelt and eating jelly donuts, although I may have had 3 souvenirs today. I stopped counting.
The jelly donuts are legit.
Oh, how can you not like any holiday that has to do with jelly donuts?
So good. And latkes, forget it. Game over. So good.
I discovered latke waffles this year. That is
a
total game changer.
Ooh, I'm going to need that recipe.
Yeah. Anyway, so we will link to this article that I referred to up top. It's on Religion News Service this week, and it's called Interfaith Term Rings Hollow for Some Jews. And it's interesting. Holly and I talked about it as she was reporting out this piece. I don't particularly care what the Jewish community calls us, and apparently there's some concern that interfaith is still excluding the partner who is not Jewish, and that even calling people the non-Jew is, you know, defining them outside the community.
Right.
I don't particularly care what terms people use as long as they are okay with our family being part of the community and not requiring me to be Jewish or to promise that the kids will only be Jewish, because it has led, it has become such a rich part of who our family is and how our children are being raised. And it has meant so much to me that we have been part of Jewish communities and Christian communities that have valued that instead of seeing it as a threat.
Yeah, I love that part in this piece where it talked about a Jewish Reform congregation in Massachusetts who works through, I guess, interfaith families, or works with interfaith families. And they were talking a little bit about the language and saying how to differentiate between being welcoming and being inclusive. And one of the people involved says, welcoming makes you feel like you're a guest, but inclusion is you belong here. And what that actually means, and like the steps that congregations are taking in this particular congregation provides like a companion to the prayer book, which offers translation and explanation of Hebrew prayers and rituals for people who are not like traditionally a part of that faith. I thought that was so beautiful. And how how faiths across the board could just do a little bit more to be welcoming and at least explanatory. Like, I mean, even like the Episcopal Church, which is incredibly welcoming to anyone, it is a, you know, very high liturgical church. A lot of stand up, sit down, a lot of like, you know, you turn and face this way, then you recite this thing, and then there's a creed, and then we all pray a prayer. I mean, there's all these sorts of things, right? And it's beautiful, but if you don't understand the meaning behind like, oh, what are these words and where did they come from? What is, like, why do we turn our bodies this way when, you know, the gospel is being walked down the aisle? Like, why do we, like, there's all these sorts of things that you just kind of naturally do as a part of that community, having been raised in it, that you inherently know that someone who walks in the door could probably figure out the mechanics of it. Like, it's, you know, not hard to like figure out when to stand up, sit down when the whole congregation is doing it. But to have a deeper understanding of the meaning of those things, I think is really beautiful. And I love that this Jewish congregation is doing that for people. And I mean, not just for people, but for these families that have spouses or children who are of another faith. I think it's fantastic. It's just awesome. I love it.
Yeah. It's such an easy way to make you either active observer or to involve you as a participant. That's a tricky line. And one that I don't try to cross over in a way that would be offensive. But, you know, for instance, for our wedding, most rabbis will not officiate an interfaith wedding, even now in 2017. So we ended up having a very good friend of mine who is a minister, who was briefly my minister, but mostly we've been long distance friends. He flew out, and then we had the father of a good friend of ours, who is Jewish and not a rabbi, but leads his family's Seder every year and loves doing, you know, all of the research about, you know, explaining the traditions. And we knew we needed somebody who would be able to do that for half of the attendees at our wedding. And we also spent a long time figuring out which pieces of the different traditions we wanted to incorporate into our wedding and then writing them out along with explanations for our guests so that nobody had to sit there feeling like an outsider, but everybody could understand what was going on and quickly understand its importance to us.
Yeah, that's beautiful. When my grandfather died last year, my grandparents on my dad's side were deeply, I mean, deeply, deeply, deeply Catholic, you know, attended mass twice a week, went to confession, like did the whole thing for his whole entire life. And when he died, he had the traditional Catholic funeral service. But my parents, who are not religious and didn't raise us in the Catholic faith, I have really no context for like that being kind of my church of like the my family of origin, like that's our family history is deeply Catholic. I don't really have any context for it. That's never been my own personal tradition, even though it was, you know, the deep faith of my grandfather. And sitting in his funeral, the priest who was doing his funeral, I remember talking to my husband afterwards how moving and how wonderful it was, because he actually walked through every element of the funeral service from a Catholic perspective and like why they do this. Like, this is what this means. This is why we do these things. This is what the incense does. This is what, you know, all the different elements of what they do. He explained it every step of the way, which for me, I'm like, my grandfather would be so happy right now knowing that everybody is getting a substantial Catholic education. At his funeral, it's like the most quintessential thing my grandfather would do. But It was just very meaningful. It actually enriched it in such a very deep way for the attendees, and especially for like my husband and I, who deeply loved my grandfather, but really did not share that connection with his tradition. And so having that deeper understanding of what he loved so much was really, really meaningful. So I can definitely kind of relate to that. Yeah. I mean, I love it when religious leaders go out of their way to kind of explain it to people, because I think it does bring a deeper meaning, like what you were saying. It makes you an active observer. And at the very least, it turns you into a student that says like, oh, I'm actually learning something here that I didn't know before, which ultimately just enriches you as a person, right? Like you walk away with knowledge that you didn't otherwise have. And when it comes to religion, I cannot think of something that we need more deeper education on at this time in history than other religions outside of our own. And so anytime people go out of their way to make that happen, I think it's just so, so, so important and really beautiful and only enriches the people that get to observe it or even experience it. It's awesome. So I get it.
Well, and in a way that will lead us to our next topic. It's going to become necessary for any religious tradition that wants to either keep adherence or bring people back to the fold, is the ability to explain the traditions and why they matter and why they're relevant. And also reach out to embrace families that are, you know, no longer just along one religious line or one ethnic line. You know, we are very messy in our unions. And I think that can be a beautiful thing, but only if our religious communities are willing to acknowledge it and deal with that reality instead of denying it. So tell us about this piece that caught your eye.
Yeah. So the story that caught my eye this week was published at BuzzFeed, who has been doing some great pieces on religious communities lately. They did the piece that I mentioned a few episodes back about Bethel in Reading, and then they did this particular piece that I'm going to talk about today. And this one featured a community of people who are merging the trends of wellness and mindfulness with Jewish practices and working really hard to make it trendy, which, you know, for better or worse, right? And in this piece, it examines their attempts at making Shabbat, or the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, cool again. But it's more than a venture into slick branding for religious rites, which I think, going back on what we were talking about in like religious communities have to figure out how to communicate their values and everything else to the masses or to new people. There's a fine line there between communicating values and what they're about and making it accessible into turning it into just like slick marketing, right? And so, but what this piece examines is more than a venture into slick branding. Underneath, it's actually a glimpse into the lives of the, quote, spiritual but not religious, or those who identify as not affiliated with any religion. And the term used to describe this particular demographic since 2012 is called the nones, so N-O-N-E-S. And there's been a lot of ink spilled on this particular demographic and what it means, but I thought it would be interesting to chat with someone who knows the nones really well, who knows their spiritual life and how they got to this point. I interviewed Kaya Oakes, who is a professor at UC Berkeley. She's an author, she's a journalist. She has written a book on the spiritual lives of the religiously unaffiliated. Kaya Oakes is an accomplished editor and religion writer, and she sits on the editorial advisory board at Religion Dispatches. Her writing has appeared in publications like The Guardian, Religion News Service, America Magazine, National Catholic Reporter, and more. She's currently a member of the faculty at UC Berkeley, where she teaches creative writing. Kaya is also an author who has written 4 books, and her most recent title is The Nuns Are All Right, A New Generation of Seekers, Believers, and Those in Between. Kaya, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Nish.
So fun to have you. So there was a piece in BuzzFeed that came out yesterday, and it was titled The Goopification of Shabbat. And for those unaware, the reference is to Goop, the oft-ridiculed yet highly sought-after and trendy lifestyle brand from Gwyneth Paltrow. On the surface, it's a piece about trendy, Instagrammable wellness communities that pull from some of the practices of Judaism, most notably the practice of Sabbath. But underneath the piece is much more than that. It's about a generation of young people who were raised in traditionally religious homes, some of them quite fundamentalist or orthodox, depending on the tradition. It's a piece about this group of young people who have broken with the traditional structures of organized religion and are sort of forging their own new spiritual path. And it's a group that sociologists and religion researchers are calling, quote, the nones. And Kaya, we'll get to your take on this particular piece in just a second, but you've done a lot of research and have written about the nuns at length in your new book. What can you tell us about them from like a cursory 30,000 foot view, and more specifically about their spiritual lives?
Well, it's this larger discussion about the nuns was really sparked in 2012 when Pew Research, which is a think tank and research foundation, released a study showing that up to between 30 and 40% of people roughly under 50, so Gen X and millennials, mm-hmm. were identifying on a survey. They would check when they asked what religion you are, they would check none. I'm no religion. But what has sort of needed to be unpacked about that in a larger sense is, what does that mean? Does that mean that they're atheists? No, because only 3% of them are actually self-defined as atheists. Mm-hmm. Are they agnostics? No, because 4% of them, only 4% say they're agnostic. They say that they believe in God. They say that they have a spiritual practice of some sort. And oftentimes when you talk to them, which is what I did for the book, I interviewed a bunch of people at length to do mm-hmm. sort of more in-depth conversations, finding out that they engage in kind of like a spiritual mix and match, or what I would call DIY religion, and pulling from different traditions and blending those together. So that's the sort of the problem, is that we're separating the poles, or the statistics sort of separate spiritual and religious. And we don't really have a good definition for either of those things today, because religious has been hijacked by the Christian right in America, and spiritual has been hijacked by marketing. So it's a weird kind of juncture. So if you ask a younger adult, are you spiritual but not religious? They go, well, religion's bad, right? So I'm not that. So a lot of people are really what we call seekers. They're just looking for something that fulfill their spiritual needs, but they're not very easily finding it.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, would you say that nuns are fully untethered from organized religion, or is that even possible to be fully untethered, since we're all kind of shaped and formed by our upbringings? How would you kind of classify them? Like, would they be like fully untethered, not a part of any religious community? Is it kind of nominal? What has been your experience talking with folks?
They're often kind of one foot in, one foot out. So the example of somebody whose parents are still somewhat religious and who goes to a worship service, maybe, you know, the Christmas, Easter in the Christian tradition, or maybe bat mitzvah of their cousin in the Jewish tradition. And they may be keeping some sort of religious practice at home, but not regularly attending a worship service. So another thing that's interesting is that everybody that I talk to, and including the atheists, and most of the people who answer these surveys, say that they think religion does a lot of good in society, but that it's too politicized. So there's this contradiction, right, between I like what religion does for the poor. I like what religion does in terms of social services, but I don't like going to a worship service and hearing about politics.
Interesting, because those things like serving the poor and those sorts of things are kind of inherently political. So that's kind of an interesting perspective there.
That's right.
Okay. So I want to touch just briefly on this BuzzFeed piece that I referenced, but not dive into it too much because folks may not have read it yet. But the piece by Maddie Kahn exposes some religious appropriation and how practices that are supposed to be deemed as sacred are now being invested in by venture capital firms who hope to make money. And in this instance, it's a profit off the link between the wellness movement and Judaism. But this piece also paints a picture of how these practices, like a trendy Shabbat dinner, are reintroducing people to religious practices. For some, it's the tradition they grew up in, and for some, it's for the first time. In your mind, is there a benefit in trying to make religion, quote unquote, cool? And is this a trend that we're seeing in the nuns' generation?
You could ask evangelicals who went to mega churches with rock bands if it worked for them.
Oh, gosh. No.
It's funny because I've been hearing from all these evangelical women in the last year or two about who did grow up in that trying to make church cool generation.
Oh, man.
With like lasers and rock bands, and it didn't work.
They really
hit a crisis point, and they're all sort of going, what do I do? And so I don't think that it leads, there's no evidence as far as I know that these kinds of things lead to any kind of long-term relationships. So it opens the door for some people, and for Jewish people, it's cultural, it's tribal, it's, you know, it's a very deep kind of connection to your ancestry that Christians, white Christians, we don't really have.
Right.
It's not really, it's so watered down. Even someone who's got Irish Catholic roots like I do. So my grandparents were surrounded by other Irish Catholics. They lived in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. By the time my parents were born in the 1930s, it was mostly, it was changing demographically. And so, and then by the time I was born in the 70s, the neighborhood was completely transformed. So you didn't have that ethnic enclave anymore. Right. And so the religion gets kind of watered down. And that has been going on for many generations in America. So white Christians don't have that same tribal connection that Jewish people do. But I don't see, I've not seen any evidence or any research that something like this, like Instagram Shabbat is gonna really bring people back in a permanent way. What tends to do that is what tends to bring people back to religious practice, if anything, is death.
Right.
So the death of a parent, the death of a child, that's when people will really start reexamining whether they want to go back into religion or not.
That's interesting. I was looking on social media, just kind of the reactions to the piece, and I was I don't know if pleasantly surprised, but I was actually like, I don't know, kind of endeared by seeing so many people actually like being almost offended by this kind of like marketed Judaism, this kind of like marketed religion. I don't want to just couch it as just Judaism. And a lot of people giving it pretty substantial pushback. Do you think that there is a danger, at the very least a downside, to people dabbling, I guess, in different religious practices outside of the bounds of its kind of historical and communal context? Do you see there being any sort of downside, aside from the fact that it's just not sustainable over the long term?
Right. I think the danger is the lack of, when something is robbed of its context and robbed of its kind of origin story, then people are engaging with it in this really superficial way. So, for example, if you read Tricycle or Lion's Roar, these Buddhist magazines, and you read Buddhist scholars, there's a lot of self-examination in Western Buddhism about this. Like, is like a hot yoga class with sutras, well, that's, you know, that come out of a Buddhist tradition and they're separated from the Buddhism, is that still religion? And so there's all this kind of cultural appropriation. And I was reading about this recently with paganism, which does have, you know, Celtic or tribal roots, mm-hmm. that witchcraft has become very trendy since the election, because women in particular are looking for a way, and non-religious women are looking for a spiritual way to work out their experiences since last year. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing things like hexing and spell casting. And so some people who are actually practicing paganism as a religion are like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You don't understand Druidism. You don't understand the religious part of it. So I think that there's a wisdom to being open to other traditions, but also like kind of looking at why this one?
Right.
And so I think the marketed stuff is like very, you know, here's a crystal and now you're pagan.
Right. You go to a Shabbat and now you're Jewish, or you
exactly,
go to a church service exactly. and now you're Christian. Right.
Exactly. So there's a kind of like way in which people are being sold a bill of goods. Like you can become religious by buying this thing or going to this dinner, there's no evidence that seems to stick.
Right. It's kind of like bending to the whim of our social media culture in a way, I think.
Yeah. And to be fair, a lot of this goes back to the religious institutions themselves that are desperately trying to retain people. And so they're doing,
right.
So they're tweeting and Instagramming and like, where are the young people? Here's our Instagram, you know,
with our super trendy font and hip website.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I want to pivot to politics just for a second. We often see religious groups get piled together in exit polls, which kind of gives us an understanding of how religious or spiritual people vote in elections. In your observations, how are the nuns voting? Is there any correlation between their disaffiliation with religious groups and their voting patterns? Have you seen any of that?
Yeah, I mean, there was clearly some, you know, before the election, a lot of the numbers were looking the same as they did after. And so they tend to be on the left, progressive on social issues, and they tend to vote Democrat. And they actually supported Hillary in the biggest numbers. They were, a lot of them were Bernie fans. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders is a nun. You know, he's secular Jewish, but he's a boomer nun.
Right.
So he's not really. And interestingly, you know, a lot of people would argue that Trump is kind of a nun, too, because he's a sort of like a fake Christian, or he right. sort of like adapts to whatever is around him, mm-hmm. you know. And so the non-religious, they do tend to be white, educated, and liberal.
Okay.
So they do tend to lean that way. And that turned out that the most religious candidate in the election was Hillary Clinton, and that mm-hmm. they voted for her. So there's no evidence that they won't vote along. They'll still, their non-religious kind of, or experimental religion or whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
It's, if the candidate's overtly religious, that's, as long as that's the candidate they believe in, they'll still vote for that person.
Interesting. The polarization of our politics is kind of reminiscent of the tribalism within American religious traditions. Are nuns choosing in some ways not to engage in that polarization? We kind of talked a little bit about Bernie Sanders being kind of the anti-establishment candidate, and you really could say that about Trump, too. Are the two parties, in your mind, doing anything to reach these nun voters who were, quote, spiritual but not religious, like what we were talking about?
No. So I think that, you know, obviously the Democrats have a better chance of doing that. But there's no, I can remember at some, I have a foggy memory of Obama saying something about non-believers. But there's no, because we don't have a lot of leadership, there's not a lot of leadership on the left right now that's very strong leadership that is speaking to those particular voters, that mm-hmm. I don't see that personally. And I'm here in California where my reps are, you know, Kamala Harris and Barbara Lee and Dianne Feinstein, and none of whom are really overtly religious, but mm-hmm. they don't especially seem to go out of their way to talk to that demographic. So I haven't seen it personally.
Okay. So this is my last question for you. What is a common misunderstanding about nuns that you feel like maybe mischaracterizes them that you could clear up for us? Because I feel like I hear a lot about nuns and that they, you know, are just kind of quote unquote bending to the whims of culture, and that, you know, they're kind of leaving without a lot of thought and without a lot of consideration. And the people that I know who have disaffiliated with their religious traditions from their, I guess, their families of origin have done so very, very thoughtfully. And I don't know if there's been anything similar in your experience where you feel like they've been kind of mischaracterized by the masses. What's something that you feel like you would want to clear up about the nuns if you could?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I think that there's this sense that it's a cavalier decision, that people just wake up one day and go, I'm going to walk away from religion, when all these factors are at play. Like, this is something that's been going on since the 80s and Generation X and Reagan and the Christian right. That's when this began. And so we're not looking at something recent. And also, it's really, as you mentioned, it's a discernment process where people really kind of painfully and agonizingly over time make the decision to cut ties with a religious tradition, or they just are so rejected because they're queer or a woman or whatever that they can't find, it's untenable. But it's never just a kind of casual decision. It's always something that involves a lot of thinking and prayer, you know, and that they do maintain a relationship with what they conceive of as the divine after they're no longer religious, and that they don't hate religion as a result of this, that they still have some sort of longing for or curiosity about the religion that goes on after they're no longer in a religion.
That's fascinating. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat about nuns and politics and all of the marketing of religion these days on Instagram and all that kind of stuff. This is a really great, really great conversation. I so appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you bet. And we will talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay, it sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Kaya. So what did you think of that interview, Amy?
She is fantastic.
Kaya is super smart.
Yeah. I think definitely the discussion about, you know, whether these kinds of trends are likely to keep people in the fold or just kind of bring them in to dabble for a little bit is a really interesting one because, you know, this specific piece and our conversation is about this particular Jewish trend, but I think it applies to a lot of places where people are just trying everything to bring in millennials to try to figure out what's going to keep people from leaving. And sometimes it's thoughtful and sometimes it's, hey, what would be cool?
Right. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting that I had this thought, which is why I asked her the question, talking about, is there a danger, at the very least a downside, to people dabbling in different religious practices outside the bounds of its historical and communal context. And her saying, like, yeah, every tradition has its very, very rich context, right? It's usually practiced within community. It has its history. It has all of this stuff that kind of surrounds it. And when you just like pluck out one aspect of it and try to plop it into kind of a cornucopia of other things that you're just doing for the heck of it, you know, it loses not just its meaning, but really its sustainability as a religious practice. And is that a detriment to the trends that we're seeing with the religiously unaffiliated? I thought that was a really interesting piece as well. And then how it's relating to politics and how the nuns are voting, how they are actually higher educated, white. It's usually the trend. I'm not surprised by, and yet at the same time to kind of hear it said out loud kind of reinforced what I already thought, which was interesting, and how they tend to lean left kind of makes sense to me.
I believe that they are the most democratic religious demographic at this point, which is one reason, and we can talk about this in another show because there is so much material, but it's one reason why it is so darn hard these days to get any Democratic professional to think seriously about doing faith outreach, because they will just come right back at you with, why should we bother? Because our biggest demographic are the people who aren't religious. And in fact, they argue that those voters would be pushed away by any attempts to reach out, which there is actually zero evidence for, because as Kaya said, these are not folks who self-identify necessarily. There's just very small percentages of them who self-identify as atheist or agnostic. These are not folks who are hostile to religion, but they don't have a strong attachment to any particular religion.
Like, and tradition, right.
Tradition. And they have been turned off by the pretty bad reputation that religion has had in our political realm for the last two decades now.
Almost three, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's something that I hope we continue discussing and maybe have some guests on to think through with us as well, because, you know, I grapple with this a lot of, you know, I think there are folks, and Joel Osteen is one of our favorite to pick on, but for good reason, I think. One way you can be popular is to make something not very difficult for people. And you know, certainly as a brand, that's what you want. You want it to be a low barrier to entry, and then keep people happy when they're in there. And yet, you know, we have a strong tradition in Christianity, particularly, and also in Judaism, of prophets challenging the people and being unpopular for it. And, you know, man, I think it's really tough, and I'm glad I'm not running a church, because, you know, trying to walk that line between, being a faithful leader who challenges the people and, calls attention to where they're stumbling, but also being someone who needs to have a roof over your head where people can gather to worship, and needs people to pay for it. That's just, it's incredibly tricky.
Super tricky. And I mean, these sorts of conversations can be applied to a bunch of different faith traditions. We can talk about it with, you know, this particular branding of Judaism. We can talk about it with the prosperity gospel stuff within Christianity. We can talk about, you know, the big rock show that is half of evangelicalism in America. We can talk about the appropriation of like yoga and those practices. I mean, there's a whole host of things that you can apply to this particular situation, or that this piece can actually address at a deeper level. So I would love to have more of these conversations to talk about, like, oh, in what ways are we commodifying religious practice for the sake of getting people in, but then cheapening that practice? What's the damage there over the long term? I would love to have those sorts of conversations. So we'll have to explore that in the new year.
Right. Well, yes, I want to put in a quick plug for the fact that, because I still keep trying to make Fox evangelicalism a thing, I wrote a piece that was in the New York Times this past Sunday called Have a Very Merry War on Christmas.
It was so good.
Thank you. I was very pleased with how it came out. It's a piece I've been thinking about for 2 years, just trying to wrap my head around what has been going on with conservative evangelicalism, and especially the sort that seems unmoored from biblical teachings and taking its cue more from Sean Hannity and the folks on Fox News and what they decide are the priorities than from what's in the Bible. The feedback I've gotten has been really just unanimously positive, which kind of creeps me out, because that's not what happens when I write about religion and politics. I usually get lots of hate mail. But what I have heard is something that I just wanted to pass along to listeners, because I think, because I've been thinking about this for 2 years, I think the piece was able to kind of articulate some critiques of evangelicalism that maybe folks have not put into words when talking with family members who are maybe in the demographic of Fox evangelicals. So I've heard people saying, you know, I'm taking this article with me home for Christmas, and maybe this time it's going to be an effective way to talk to people, because it comes much more from a place of sorrow than anger in terms of what has happened to our tradition. So I just want to throw that out there as a recommendation. As you mentioned, Nish, with the new year, this is our last show for 2017, and we cannot end without thanking our listeners so much for the gift of your time and support. We know there aren't enough hours in the day, and the fact that you choose to spend some time listening to the two of us is a privilege that we do not take lightly.
We broke into the top 100 on iTunes Most Popular News and Politics podcast this week, and we were even briefly at number 46, which is...
We're 46,
right? Celebrate mediocrity. It's amazing. it is seriously incredible. All of the other podcasts that are listed in like the news and politics section are like the New York Times and Slate Gabfest and Pod Save America, like all these big heavy hitters. And then there's just little Amy and me in polite company crushing it.
So for an independent religion and politics podcast from two evangelical-ish women, that's pretty freaking amazing. So we really can't thank you guys enough. It's been kind of a crazy ride. I don't know about you, Amy, but I never in a million years expected that it would be this widely received and that people would want to talk about this stuff, but I guess right place, right time.
Well, and this much fun.
Oh gosh, it's so much fun.
I don't think people know, Nish, you and I had not ever actually spoken before we recorded the trailer, which is kind of insane.
It is a little crazy. Like, we just decided, oh yeah, this will be great. This is a good idea.
I know you from Twitter. This will work out.
This will be fine. This will be fine. Such a bad idea. Do not follow our example. It was sheer luck and the grace of God that is what has made this work, let's be honest. But it's been super fun. I have loved it, and I am so excited for 2018. It is going to be, it's going to be a wild ride.
It cannot be worse.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare put that evil on me. You know it can be worse.
Yeah. All right. To wrap up the show, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation, maybe a TV show, a movie, a podcast. Nish, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, I have two things. I'm cheating. The first one, I'm actually going to plug you again because you were on with Friends Like These over at Crooked Media with Anna Marie Cox.
I was.
Talking about one of our favorite things to talk about, Democrats and abortion politics. Abortion. What else is more fun to talk about on the internet for everyone to hear than abortion? I loved that episode. Anna is so great. She fosters really great conversations over there. So if you haven't listened to it, make sure you catch the episode. The podcast is called With Friends Like These, and it's with the Crooked Media guys. They do a really great job. So catch Amy over there. And my second thing is, Amy, we're out of control over here. We're starting another series. And
oh no.
I know. We're out of hand. We are watching too much TV. I don't know what to do with it. But last night we watched the first episode of a show called Gunpowder. And it is HBO, of course. I love HBO. But it is produced and co-created by and starring none other than Mr. Jon Snow himself, Kit Harington.
What?
Yeah.
How did I not know about this?
Ooh. I must say that the first episode, wow, super intense, very gory, because it is about the plot to bomb Parliament.
The Guy Fawkes?
The Guy Fawkes story. Yes. So we're talking about, like, the persecution of the Catholics in England during that time.
And that was a nasty time.
Ooh, I did not. I mean, I knew a little bit about just the history of, you know, the plot to bomb Parliament, but I did not know the lengths of persecution that Catholics went through during that time. And you see it, like, the first half of the episode is like it is fully in that history. And so you see people getting executed, and you see, I mean, by torture, by, it is really, really brutal. So I was not prepared for that, like, not emotionally prepared. I had to stop watching for a minute. I had to turn my head away because it was very intense to watch a more kind of dramatic historical reenactment of it. And of course, it's starring Kit Harington, who I love, Jon Snow forever. It is super, super good. So the first episode was a little intense, even for me. And I'm a Game of Thrones watcher, and it was intense for me. I'm going to keep watching. So I'm going to see. I'm going to see how it goes. If it's still a little too intense, I may pull the brakes on it. But so far, it's really, really good. So we'll see. That's my choice. What about you? What are you watching, listening to?
Well, I am going to shake up the category a little bit and throw out a cookbook.
Yes, please.
Because 'tis the season to be cooking and baking. Mostly baking, but I love making soups particularly.
Oh, me too.
When it is warm or when it is cold outside, warm inside, I just want a nice hearty soup. Not things floating in them, though. They must be smooth. So I have found a fantastic, oh, you will begin to learn about my life as a recovering picky eater. Mostly recovered.
So, okay, good to know.
I like my soups smooth. Fortunately, I was staying with my good friend Holly Rossi, who wrote the article we talked about.
That's right.
And she and I have so many things in common, but among them is our love of food. And so she had given me the Flour Cookbook a couple of years ago from the Flour Bakery in Cambridge and in Boston, which is famous for its sticky buns. And it's possible that I brought four home on the plane with me, but only ate one. So I think that was pretty good, especially because we were stuck on the runway for more than an hour.
Good self-restraint.
It was. It was monumental self-restraint. But she has a second cookbook called Flour 2, T-O-O, that has more savory stuff because in addition to being a bakery, Flour sells sandwiches and like light lunch and dinner stuff and soups. And let me tell you, I made a sweet potato and coconut and curry soup.
What?
Which, yes, was just a fantastic combination. Like a little bit spicy, but with some sweetness, and put some of my favorite Trader Joe's like unsweetened coconut flakes on top for a little crunchiness. So, so good.
Oh, man.
So
now I got to put something else on my Amazon list.
Or I'll just send you the recipe. But
oh yeah,
everybody else, buy the book. It's really just scrumptious.
Super excited about that. Okay, well, that is all for this week's episode. And that is all for 2017. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast, and please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we'll post the links to our show notes as well. And until next year, have fun storming the castle, kids!